Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 69, Untranslatable. Russian Western Zen, a conversation with A. Malatkov. Malatkov moved to the U.S. in 1990 and switched to writing in English in 1993. His work has been accepted by Kenyon Review, Mad Hatter's Review, Two River, Perihelion, Word Riot, Identity Theory, and many more. Malatkov is winner of New Millennium Writings and Kopo Fiction Contests, among others. He co-edits the Inflectionist Review. Malatkov's new translation of a Chekhov short story was included by Knopf Random House in their Everyman series edition of Fishing Stories. Also, A. Malatkov's haiku and very short poems appear regularly in the Haiku Calendar published by All Book Books. And to check out more of his work, you can visit him at amalatkov.com. This is your host, Monk. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. dance in a chase of signs. First you ask questions, then you know enough to answer. But who is there to ask the right questions?
Each other a bunch of years, so your unofficial nickname is Tola. So how are you doing today?
Hi, Mike. I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I appreciate it, and I can't wait to talk about poetry and all that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you.
It's great. It's great to, you know, we've talked on the phone before, and we met. You did a reading. We did a reading together, so that was exciting after, you know, being e-connected for a while to actually meet someone. That's like a somewhat common thing nowadays.
It was wonderful.
Yeah. So, yeah, your stuff, your writings that I've been reading for years, mostly your poetry, but also know a little bit about your overall arts. And, like, I'm always amazed because you do so many things. You know, you've written a novel, you put together a CD, just played a couple of tracks, and that CD has, I don't know, it's like 15 or 20 people on it playing music and doing spoken word. Wow, maybe just start off saying a little bit about how you know, pull all that together, because I know how much it takes to just even do like a poetry reading with one person or two people.
Well, sure. I was really interested in doing something in other genres just to expand my perspectives and try something else and maybe view the whole creative process from a different angle. So, I, of course, being a poet, wanted to combine the poetry with some music. I love Eastern instruments, Indian and Arabic instruments, so I invited everybody I could find who plays exotic instruments, along with more regular ones like guitars and drums. Yeah. And I recorded everybody separately, and then I worked in the mix, combining the different instruments that I had recorded into one CD. So basically it's a collage of instruments that were recorded separately, although a lot of them are sounding as though they were actually recorded together.
Okay, yeah, that's always the tricks of the trade where, you know, you don't know how stuff got pulled together. But it's a beautifully put together CD called Can You Stay Forever? With a question mark. And yeah, it's amazing layout. You've got like little photos and boxes for each of the tracks with the poetry written on it, and and the instruments are like, I always learn a lot because you've got some instruments I never heard of. I mean, you've got silver flutes, sarangi, tabla, I know, and then didgeridoo, the pifano, P-I-F-A-N-O, what's that?
It's a Mexican flute, a ceramic flute of a specific shape.
Wow, so when did you start getting into, you know, the multicultural nature of music?
That's a good question. I think it's probably in the 90s. I was always into adventurous music, avant-garde music, but I've also been noticing that the Western arrangements kind of tire me, and I've become too familiar with them. So I thought something different. And in the mid-90s, I was seeking out unusual bands and also music from other parts of the world that influenced me a lot.
Wow, neat. Any particular ones that, you know, jump to memory?
Well, I guess one of the first musicians I listened to was Ravi Shankar. Everybody knows, of course, yeah. And Ali Akbar Khan.
Oh, yeah.
Who is also a famous Indian player. He's a sarod player.
Mm-hmm.
And Indian music was one of my first immersion. But also Arabic music. I played Dubek, which is an Arabic drum Yeah. So I listened to a lot of music from Algeria and, Middle East in general, and pretty much anything that I could get my hands on that compelled me to listen to it. Japanese music, South American music, all kinds of stuff.
Neat. Now you take that. What's interesting to me is, like, listening to some of the music tracks, it's like you take that, and it, along with your writing, it becomes very non-traditional, I guess. You know, some people call it experimental or avant-garde. That's part of why your stuff, it has some of a Zen quality to me, because it reminds, like, some of the Zen principle is, like, about, having a direct perception into reality rather than something you've been told or something you read or, that kind of thing. So a lot of times your pieces, like, they bring up these questions and they make me question, like, what I think I know, or they question reality. So, I don't know if that's something you sort of consciously started doing, or you're just drawn to, presenting things that way. It seems like both the music and the writing fits that.
I think that that's always been my interest in arts, the deeper, bigger questions. I'm not drawn to superficial art, which sounds judgmental, of course, but maybe I should rephrase it. I'm not as much drawn to the art that has very limited application in time or in space. I'm interested more in the kind of art that anybody can relate to without regard to their geographical background or cultural background. The more universal topics and the great questions of the human condition are the ones that interest me most. And I think that's what you're referring to when you mentioned the Zen, right?
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of putting it. It's, I guess it's sort of hard. Like, a lot of the Zen stories, they ask the teacher, how do you describe this? And the answers are a lot of times sort of sideways. They don't really answer directly, because it's like trying to put in words what can't be put in, exactly in words. So
it's exactly.
Yeah, maybe. How about start off reading something? Maybe the book that I picked the title Untranslatable for this, because one of your poems that I really love is The Hunger for Information.
Well, certainly. I'd love to read that one.
First, I just want to say it's in a chat book, True Stories from the Future, and that won an award, actually. It won the award from Long Island, actually, a publisher I know that doing a chapbook award. I forgot the name of the
Boonstock Press.
Yeah, Boonstock Press, and it was it like a Walt Whitman Award or contest or something like that?
Right, yeah. Right. Walt Whitman.
Yeah, award. He described on the back of the book. He describes your work. The book, there is a genuine depth in this work that I believe transcends the words on the page, to accomplish something far greater, something beyond language, and perhaps something we will understand only as we might understand the future, as a bright, open canvas for us. So that's kind of some of what I meant, some of what I mean by this.
She was very kind, yes.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so is this one you picked? Because I had asked you to pick one to read in Russian, too, because I need to hear the language. I don't know if you're going to read this one in Russian or you have another one picked out.
I have another one in Russian. Okay. That's also from this chapbook called The Shot. But to begin with, let me read the poem called Hunger for Information, which I know Mike is one of. Once you appreciate hunger for information. Tell me another story in that language I don't know. May the syllables become building blocks for a lighter life. May vowels sing all answers. May consonants keep a steady rhythm of truth. May your story remain untranslatable. May it be endless.
Well, very nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, sometimes hard after poetry, something like that, to know what to say next. Let's see. Now, you've got, also you have started, like, you told me about it, this term to describe poetry, inflectionism, is that the term?
Yes,
can you say,
that's right.
Can you say a little bit about that? And I think you guys started a journal.
That's correct. 3 of us got together a few years ago to discuss what we love about poetry and to perhaps formulate an approach that resonates with us. And we came up with Inflectionism then. About a year ago, we started an Inflectionist Review, and that's a magazine that's based on the aesthetics. The idea of Inflectionism is about poetry or art in general that leaves room for the reader. When I say that, I mean poetry that doesn't over-explain, that leaves enough interpretive space for the reader to make their own conclusion. So it's more of a question than an answer, and it's more open-ended, the kind of poetry that we include, that we try to write.
That's neat. Like, I think that touches on why I love haiku so much, because that's part of haiku, is to convey what the experience was. Like, you know, if I am just so moved by something, I want to put that into a few words, so hopefully you can be moved by it. You know, it's not like that I saw this and I want to tell you what I saw. It's like trying to convey something. So it's, you know, it's similar to that. I know we've had some good discussions about haiku, because I'm kind of a mix of the traditional and some of the more, you know, trying to stretch the boundaries. And I know you like to do, like, much more sort of, you know, just kind of twist things in a provocative way, more so than just the traditional nature poetry.
Right. I have trouble with traditions. That's true.
That's cool. I guess perhaps that's how some traditions get made, or something. You know, there's got to be people like that on the with the planet. So, you know, we don't get stuck in ruts. So.
I hope so. Thanks for saying that.
Yeah. Let's see what else. They can check out your website too. It's quite a mix. It's amolotkov.com. I'll put it up on, you know, the web link where I do all information for the shows. And you know, it's quite a, you've got photographs and some of your your poetry and music, and then you had written a novel a while ago, and that in itself, I think I got this off your site, the description of the novel, I'll read that, and then it gives the flavor of your stuff, and you can comment on it if you would. The novel's called Everything. Everything is a film that is being made and viewed at the same time. You are in the audience. The actor and the actress reenact events from the lives of the character and the characteress. Somehow, Gumbelt and Zungvilda are also part of it. Are they actors or the characters? And who is having that conversation threading through the entire novel? And are the characters aware that they are being filmed? And who is invited to the dinner party?
That's a lot of questions.
Yeah, you don't have to answer all of them. But, that's part of what I was mentioning earlier, was that thing about, you know, just that whole question that some artists do. Like, some people present just, this is the way it is, and it's real, and it can be quite powerful. And other people are questioning, you know, the reality of, you know, who is acting and who is, you know, that whole thing. So maybe say a little about how you approach that.
Well, that's a good question. When I started as a writer, when I was about 14, mm-hmm. I was very moved and interested in avant-garde. So Stranger Something was the more chance it had to appeal to me. Coming from that perspective, I was always more interested in narratives that are complicated, that contain twists and contradictions and perhaps multiple voices. And so for many years, those were the kinds of things I would write in my novels or my short stories. However, now that I'm in my mid-40s, I think that my interest for the avant-garde has waned a little bit, and in favor of an interest for just a good story, a compelling story. So the novel I'm finishing now, called The Escaping Truth, is actually just a real story, and that's sort of a bit of a turn for me in terms of fiction.
That's interesting. That's fascinating, because I guess, you know, if someone's avant-garde, I guess at a certain point, you know, how much can you keep, if you keep doing something different, I don't know. But, you know, a lot of artists that I admire a lot, like singers Dylan and Neil Young, I mean, when I've heard them talk about they're like, do one thing, but then they're not trying to just redo what they did. They keep exploring and they keep staying fresh. I think that's essential for, artists to stay out of a rut and keep keep exploring. So it's neat to hear you're doing something different. What is the story in any particular place or time?
Well, the story is set in a particular place, but it's not defined. It's a small town in North America, probably in the United States. And the story deals with a character who is sort of lost in life, and he goes out and sits on people's porches. His thoughts are that he's just observing when they're not home. But, of course, people start finding him on their porches, and so he eventually makes a few connections that change his life, change the lives of people he meets in various ways. And so it's a study of human interaction, in a way, of how we approach others and what it takes to empathize with others.
That's neat. I think that happens every day, you know, when you just see someone out and about, and whether you connect or not, the difference, you know, makes a huge difference.
That's true, and every small interaction could matter.
Yeah, good luck. Good luck with the novel. When do you think it's going to be done? How long does it usually take you, like, to write a novel? Or
in this case, it's taken me about a year and 3 months so far. I'm on draft three, so
wow.
I'm pretty sure I'm going to have another 3 months to work on draft four before I can consider whether it's finished or not. So
right.
It's going to be a few more months.
Yeah, and it's interesting for just arts and day-to-day wise, you do computer consultation, right, by day job or sort of day job?
That's right.
Yeah, that was one thing I thought of when I was thinking about the show, was to ask you, is there like kind of a left brain, right brain thing going on for you, or does it all kind of flow together, you know, because the technical stuff, and then when you switch to artist, is that like a different hat, or does it sort of similar, is there a similarity to it?
Well, that's a good question. I think there is a similarity in that I do computer programming, which is fairly creative.
Huh.
Not as creative as poetry, but you do get to make creative choices. For example, you need to implement a particular feature for your client, and so you decide what is the easiest way for users to work that feature. And you create something that is as transparent and as user-friendly as possible. In a way, that can be said about art, too. You want to care about your reader, and you want to write something that your readers will relate to. So in that way, I think it's similar. It's also a kind of work in which intuition has a definite place, because sometimes programming can be so complicated that you can't really quite understand it, so you take a guess to try to achieve a different result, and that's where intuition comes in.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Thank you.
Did you want to
I don't know.
Oh, sorry. Did you want to say more about that? Or?
No, I think that's about it. I don't know exactly if it's left brain versus right brain, but logic also comes into place in both cases. So I think it's more along a mix of different brain activities, not so much the separation of left and right.
Yeah, I got excited. I was jumping in to say something, because that's a beautiful explanation. It gives me a whole other appreciation for, like, you know, what computer programming does, the way you described it, as kind of in an artistic sense of sort of, you know, you really care about the person, but you also, you know, you want to step back out of the picture in the sense that we're talking about with art, so the, you know, the reader or the user can enjoy it. And then also in the sense of the intuition and the in-the-moment stuff that happens with writing, because that's one of the things I love the best, is the creativity that happens while writing. So it sounds similar with the computer intuition. Yeah, it's a sort of very much behind the scenes, but yet it comes out in whatever gets created. Another area that you have a lot more experience. I've done a little bit of entering contests, so I was thinking, you know, listeners might find it fascinating, and some people who are into, you know, how do I get my work out there, and, you know, can you say a little about, I think it's mostly poetry, but you've also done some short stories, right? You enter contests a lot.
Yes, I did win a couple of short story contests, to various places, not the first place, and a couple of poetry contests.
Mm-hmm.
Contests are definitely an interesting phenomenon in the current day's literary landscape, in that many poetry titles come out of poetry contests, because basically for poetry there is not enough readership to make it commercially viable. So in a way, poets support other poets, whether it be by buying their books or by enrolling in a contest that, as a result, publishes one book. So our mileage might vary greatly. You could be submitting forever and never win anything, or you could, I've heard of people submitting just a few times and winning contests. But I view it as a way of not only potentially improve my own career, but also as a way to help the art of poetry in general. So that's my way of not feeling bitter about winning hundreds of times and not winning.
That's a good attitude. And I read some guy that would, the minute he got a rejection, he would just take like the poem and, you know, send it somewhere else right away. So I like that sense of just keeping the flow and not feeling rejected by it, because that's, you know, you have to be able to take rejection to deal with that stuff.
For sure, and it's very legitimate. I think that there are so many different literary tastes that I would be naive to expect that everybody would like any given piece of work, whether it be fiction or poetry. So it's only natural that a selective process has to take place. And of course, rejections hurt, but I think you cannot live without.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Tolda, because there's one, I won't mention the magazine, but it's like sort of an established magazine, and I tried maybe two or three times. I really wanted to get into it in that sense of, you know, it's nice to get into a magazine where it's like, hey, this is established, and I made it in. So after not getting in a couple few times, I read some little blurb, you know, by one of the editors about the types of poems they were looking for. And that was like, I had this aha moment, because the type of poem they were looking for was not the type of poem that I write.
Right.
You know, so then I was like, oh, no wonder I'm not getting into this one. It sort of helped me, let go of that feeling of, you know, dang, what am I, you know, how come I didn't get into that?
Right, definitely. Many magazines have an aesthetic that I don't personally appreciate necessarily, and in return, they don't appreciate my work. I think that's right. That's really legitimate.
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe you can read the magazine to find out the type of poem. You know, it's not like I was trying to submit a poem about, you know, fish to aeronautics magazine, but it was, you know, you can do some research, but, you know, from reading some of the journal, I hadn't noticed specifically what this, you know, an editor had mentioned actually in an edition, at the beginning of an edition, so that was where the sort of light bulb was for me.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, because, you know, I didn't mean this, I don't want it to be like, you have, you know, people have no idea what their magazines are. You have some sense of which magazines you're applying, you know, sending your stuff to, I think, obviously. All right, hey.
I do.
What'd you say?
I said I do, and occasionally I will send work to magazines that don't seem to have the correct aesthetic for my work, just in case, just to see what happens. I hope that maybe the different aesthetic would shake somebody up and get through to them, even though that's not their cup of tea on a regular basis. So that's another thing. It's a kind of, the chance is probably pretty low, but I try that every now and then.
That's another great idea. It's neat how you apply the sort of, you do different things. You apply that avant-gardeness to actual, you know, real life, in a sense, not to diminish the arts, but, you know, just the fact that you send, you know, stuff somewhere that, instead of just thinking right inside the box, oh, this is a magazine about, you know, fish, and I'll send a fish poem. It's like, hey, why not send something else? See what happens. So I don't know how I got on the fish thing, but anyhow, hey, Tola, how about another poem or whatever you got picked out to read?
Sure. This one is called A Song. If you were an icicle, would I melt you or keep you frozen? If you were a mountain, would I set out to climb you or spend my life below? If you were a person, would I speak to you or run in fear? If you were a song, would I hear or sing you?
Yeah, that's lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah, I like how you meant all of a sudden in the poem, like if you were a person, so it made me stop and think like, oh, yeah. All right. Hey, well, I'll keep read some more, because nice sort of in the middle or flow of this time for just to listen a little bit more. Okay,
read some more.
Yeah, read whatever you feel like.
There's a slightly longer poem called Assignment.
Oh, what is it called again?
It's called Assignment.
Oh, Assignment, okay.
Winter is the size of my palm. It holds few things. Its white fingers fragile like the bat. The wind outside steals your breath, breaks your focus, turns you into a message. I bend you every day because I love you. Ask the rock about the sky. Moon's eye stares indiscriminate above us. When we die, we become old stories, and some of us already are. Our love flows back to death. A promise of love is stronger than love itself. If I believed just one truth, I would take a vow of speech. Can you explain birds and their song, or the spider's gray effort? I make a gesture of openness, I sound in the world. If I'm wrong, may the future discard me. I mold a love from my ruins. I'm a monument more lost than meant. I'm a silence mistakes fall into. I build broken futures and fallen past from my loss. The air is always mixed with blood. Your shadow pursues me. It's also mine. It flows on the wind. The distance between us cannot be crossed. I stop to think. The wind stops. I had learned to be alone before I was born. As I grow old, my shadow changes into a sparrow perched on a branch. The branch breaks. It's too easy to see in the daytime. Speak with last year's leaves for sentences. Use the wind's grammar, the ocean's syllables. The stars are letters in an ancient alphabet. Our lives are written in the sky in cipher. Ask the rock about time. Ask the sky about the effort of wrapping the whole planet. I'll wake you for the sun's entry. If we see darkness on our own terms, will we break the rules or will the rules break us? The future hides behind entropy. Speak to me as a lost messenger who tried all life long but failed at the only task assigned. Bend me. Tell me your future thoughts, not the present. When I'm gone, say my famous last word.
Hmm. Wow, beautiful, nice poem, and very well read. There's so much emotion.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, the parts where you ask the rock and whatever else you're asking, and I think there was a line something like, "I was alone before I was born." Is that it?
I learned to be alone before I was born.
Yeah, that's really neat. That reminds me. There's a Zen koan that's what was your face before you were born? You know, something that they're given to the student to just meditate on. And what was your face before you were born? So it reminded me of that.
Oh, that's very interesting question.
So let's see, another topic is I'm amazed when people learn English and then, you know, they write so well or speak it so well. Sometimes you use words and I'm like scrambling for the dictionary. So it's, English is such a such a tricky language. What was it like when you you started learning English and then decided to write in English, coming from Russia?
I was very lucky in that my parents had hired an English teacher for me. When I was 7, so for a while, for about 5 years, I had weekly English lessons, which is a slow progress, but still, it gave me a foundation to work from. So when I moved to the States in 1990, I was 22, and had a fairly decent command of the grammar and some vocabulary. But of course, when I first arrived in the States, I couldn't understand what people were saying because people speak fast and they mumble. So that's a couple of months to overcome. Now, I started writing in English about 3 years later after my arrival in the States. And this was just a practical move because I lived in the country and it would have been silly to keep writing in a language of an especially a country that was in turmoil at that time, was still kind of in trouble. But this is all good because I've discovered that English is actually a fabulous language to write in and much more fun to write in than Russian. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is that English has most words. And as you mentioned just a minute ago, there are so many words that you often find yourself hearing one that is unfamiliar. If you're looking for a synonym, there'd be like 7 or 8 synonyms where Russian might have 2 or 3. As a writer, that's very valuable. You just enjoy the broader palette of words. And that's one major preference I have for English. Then the other thing about English is that it's very compact. If you translate an English paragraph to almost any other language, it will be longer. So the compactness, flexibility, the wide choice of words make English such a fabulous language to work in. Of course, it took me a while to feel more comfortable with it and could grasp the minute details of grammar and idioms that people use. And I'm still learning, but it's fun. And in a way, knowing 2 languages contributes to your ability to think creatively, I think.
It's only what? So what'd you say? 2 languages?
I said that knowing more than 1 language.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah, that's fascinating because you know, I interviewed with Teokasin Ghost Horse. He's Lakota on the show, and you know, at one point I think he said something like 25% of Lakota language cannot even be translated into English. You know, that they have these concepts and things about the world or whatever that's just it's even hard to put into English words. So the whole topic of language is fascinating. You know, it's neat to hear from your perspective pointing out, you know, what fascinates you about the English language.
Yeah, definitely. And also the languages tend to lead to different sentence structures. So in a way, you think a little differently. In some languages, you have the subject first and the verb. And that's a big difference than languages which have the verb precede the subject. Just the way of thinking about the world changes when you change that.
Yeah, that was there was one of Teokasin's radio shows where he did the native talking from the native perspective, and they could go like a whole day without using nouns. It's a very verb oriented language, and one of the simplest. Yeah, I think it's called there's some DVD of the spirituality of language. I'm not sure, but anyhow, the example the guy gave was like, you know, we see a kid playing with a ball, and we would, you know, English language look out and see, oh, he's playing with the ball, and then the native indigenous people would more likely say, oh, look at the bouncing, you know, there's something, there's an activity, it's alive. So it's a fascinating thing to realize that, you know, to see action and nouns and get into that whole topic.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, we kind of segueing to something I wanted to bring up. So it's interesting. I always find interesting people from other areas or other cultures what their comment is on American culture. And you're saying people speak fast and mumble. That makes me laugh a bit, and it because there's a lot of truth to that. And
I think that I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to mention that I think that's in general true, not only about it. English speakers, and most native speakers of their own languages would do that.
Okay. Yeah, I think other cultures sometimes do it too, but probably because I'm, you know, growing up on the East Coast where people tend to speak faster, there's that level of amusement to it. But it reminds,
right.
It reminded me, yeah, I remember a bunch of years ago, I met this, I told you about him, a Hungarian filmmaker who had recently shared, Baluk Csaba,
I love his work.
Yeah, when he came to, I remember he came to America for, I think it was his first time, and he described the thing, his impression was big and light, like, you know, I think what he meant was sort of this, you know, my interpretation is sort of like, sort of this sort of Costco attitude of, you know, everything sort of big and sort of hollow and empty, you know, not, no offense to Costco. A lot of people go there and get good deals, but I'm just using his example of like, you know, buying, you know, a 50 pack of paper towels. And it's sort of like you're saving money, but it's actually using a lot of paper. And it's just thing of, it's interesting to see what words come to people's minds to describe, you know, culture.
Yeah, it's everything on a grand scale here in America, which could be good, but could be too much, depending on the circumstance.
Yeah, yeah. And then, the segue was because he's the one that had turned me and a bunch of friends on to Tarkovsky, the Russian film director, and that's, you know, become, I think, probably my all-time favorite movie called Stalker, which is nothing to do with stalking women, but it's about, you know, a guy who helps people go through this kind of mystical zone. And, you know, since then, I've talked, you made a few suggestions, and I watched a bunch more Tarkovsky movies. So, say something about, you know, film or what that influence of somebody like that, you know, Tarkovsky has had on you and, you know, personally in your work.
Sure. I have been always a film buff since my early teenage years. Sought out the opportunities to see foreign films or old films, which were occasionally shown in Russia as long as they were not in any way criticizing the communist regime. The art of film became important, and I value and appreciate it for its ability to combine the several existing arts into one word. Obviously, you have a literary aspect, you have text, and then you have the visuals, you have the music. So much comes together to create a movie. If it's a good one, it has the potential to have more impact than any other art form, in my opinion. And Andrei Tarkovsky is just, like with the case with you, is my favorite director, which I don't usually say in other art forms.
Mm-hmm.
Usually it's hard for me to pick one favorite, but in film, definitely Tarkovsky. There is something about his work that has gone further than any other director has been able to go so far. There is a lyrical tenderness to it, but also profound investigation of the human reality, psychology, ethics. So he has the ability to be light about these very complicated and serious matters, and to find an elegant way to portray these fundamental deliberations in the course of a film that is also compelling emotionally and in many ways beautiful as a moving picture. So his work has definitely had a great impact on me in many respects.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, like myself too, I try to avoid like having one particular favorite. It's so hard. There's so many good writers or whatever artists. But yeah, there's something in his movies, especially in Stalker, there's just like scenes where I feel like I'm not watching a movie. I'm literally experiencing life, and there happens to be a film on the screen. So like that to me is like it sort of, you know, transcends. It's not so much about a favorite. It's just sort of just a piece of art that goes beyond its label, and in that sense, you know, becomes a favorite because it's so fresh each time.
Definitely, and Andrei Tarkovsky has this book about filmmaking called Sculpting in Time, and to me the metaphor of sculpting in time is very beautiful and appropriate for the art film. It's very difficult, I'm assuming, to fit a narrative into just about an hour and a half, and so that time aspect becomes especially important in a film. That book is just a wonderful piece of work on art in general, the art of film. I highly recommend that, Sculpting in Time.
Yeah, I've read little bits. It's sort of on my list to get to at some point. Just other, sometimes, you know, you have a category of books that take precedence, but I'm certainly interested in that, the whole concept. I read a little bit about him talking about his work and his philosophy behind it, and it's very deep. It's like what you mentioned, just look, you know, looking at the whole human condition and just exploring what is life and reality and all those fun questions. Have you ever heard of John Cage? I wanted to ask you. He's an American. He did a lot with sound and music.
Yes, of course I have. I've heard a lot of John Cage, and I've heard a lot of John Cage's opinions, and I find him an extremely interesting character without really liking his music, if I may say so.
Uh-huh.
For those who don't know about his work, he would create some fairly extreme experiments. Like he has a piece called, I think, 3 Minutes of 15 seconds. I might be wrong on the numbers.
Yeah.
But it's a piece that has no music in it. The orchestra just doesn't play. So that kind of conceptual joke, or maybe joke is not an appropriate word, the conceptual statement would be characteristic of his work. To me, it's interesting, but it exhausts its interest upon a first encounter, so you can't enjoy that kind of work more than once. So for me, those kinds of efforts are a little limited, but of course I appreciate the conceptual contribution they make to the art.
Yeah, that's interesting. The first time I had heard him was in college, and they played probably a reel-to-reel player, and they played like this soundtrack. It was a 20-minute thing. I don't know if he was there or live. I don't think he was there, but they played like a 20-minute track, and it started off with somebody talking. And they kept playing it slower and slower and slower. So, you know, it started off, hello, how are you? And after 5 minutes, it was like, hello, how are you? And then, you know, by the end of it, it was just like, you know. So the fact that I remember it, obviously it made a huge impression on me. So I don't know what the value or worth, but it's just fascinating.
Yes, there is a great value in poking holes at the expectations of what people come to expect from music or from any other form of art.
I think what it did say was this sort of something about the voice and sound, you know, that in sound that maybe sounds meaningless, there actually, you know, there is a voice that just happens to be slowed down, or that in the voice that's talking fast and there are words, but there actually is a sound in there. So, you know, I think when I think about it, it's saying something interesting.
Yeah, definitely. There's always something really fascinating behind those concepts.
Anything else you want to, add or something? Anything you want to mention before have you wrap up and read some poems and hear a little bit in Russian? But anything you want to mention or something you want to, you know, promote a next project or whatever?
Maybe I can mention that the magazine that we run, the Inflectionist Review, that you mentioned, is open to submissions, and we accept work year-round. Currently putting together our issue 2. So if you go to inflectionism.com, that's where we live, and it explains our aesthetic and has a link to submissions. So we would welcome poetry submissions to the Inflectionist Review from anybody who feels that their work is along these lines. That's about it. I think you've covered a lot of information about me, so I appreciate that.
Oh, yeah, it's wonderful. It's fascinating, again, to hear you, the different ways you apply, you know, different, whatever, it's hard to put words, but like a different way of thinking, but just a way of approaching life in general. That's what I've gotten from talking to you and learned about you. So how about some more poem or poems or whatever you feel like finishing up with?
Okay. You asked me to perhaps read a poem in Russian just to give the listeners flavor of what that sounds like. So I have a poem that I can read in Russian and then in translation, and also a couple of fairly short other poems in English that I could read, if that's not too much.
Yeah, that's wonderful, and I'm looking forward, because my mom's side of the family is from Russia, so I don't know much about her, really know the language at all, but just hearing it stirs something in me, so I'm excited that way. All right, go for it.
Great. Well, this poem is called A Shot. I will read it in Russian first, and then I read the English translation. Укол. Медсестра в больнице. Напоминающее привидение не только своим халатом, но и цветом лица. Делала мне укол, пытаясь уговорить меня перестать острить. Я схватил ее руку и прижал к губам, целуя ее нежно и робко, как руку святой. И когда она перестала пытаться вырвать руку, я заметил слезы в ее глазах, истосковавшихся по любви. A shot. A nurse at the hospital, ghost-like, not only due to her uniform, but also the color of her face, was giving me a shot, trying to persuade me to stop making jokes. I grabbed her hand and pressed it to my lips, kissing it gently and timidly like a saint. And when she stopped trying to pull it away, I noticed tears in her eyes, longing for love.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'll read a poem called a very short poem called The Scarf. I don't often write political poetry, but let's just, you could call it a political poem. It's called The Scarf. I walk to the market wearing a headscarf. I'm less seen than darkness, less heard than death. I wear women's garb to feel what it means to exist. Religious police would be shocked by my beard hidden behind a black fabric. Allah, too, hides his face behind a myth. May our hidden stories shape the future.
Very nice. Like, that's one that's got a lot to it. Sometimes I hear poetry and I appreciate it, but I also want to read it too, so that one fits that category. I'd want to read it to see what's going on there more so.
Oh, great. I would definitely be happy to forward it.
All right, super.
If you don't mind, I will conclude with this poem called A Violin Lesson.
Excellent.
An old man is like a violin. He remembers the tree he was made of. The tree remembers being a man. If we cross the river, will the water remember us as we are or as we think we are? If the river's memory had to track each rivulet, it would overflow, burst into an ocean. The old man moves in slow motion because his feet remember the truth. Nothing ends, not if you are part of the ending. The river remembers the bridge. Remembering our crossing is the ocean's job. The old man is the ocean, the river, the violin. Let's play it.
Wow, that's beautiful too. Very nice poem. The line that jumps out at me was something like, if nothing ends, if you're part of the ending. I like that a lot. It's like that kind of consciousness shift of seeing it as like, oh, if you're part of it, then it doesn't end.
Right.
I don't know if that's what you meant, but that's what I got from it.
Well, it's a long answer what that meant, but generally I appreciate the chance for the readers to stick what I may have meant rather than trying to say myself.
Oh, yeah, I hear you on that one. It's always like, oh, glad you got that. Hey, let's go have a cup of coffee or something.
Right.
So thanks so much, Atoll. I really enjoyed this. Wonderful talking with you. And going to finish up after this with your little short track called Gone from your CD, Can You Stay Forever? So,
thank you so much.
Appreciate
Mark.
You taking the time out of your busy schedule and sharing some wonderful insights and some of your heart.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you. You always ask wonderful questions, and I've learned so much from you as well during the time that we've known each other. It's a true pleasure and an honor for me to do this interview.
Wow, thanks a lot. And yeah, maybe we continue on, exploring the arts and life, and then sharing that with each other. So thanks again.
Very well.
All right. Thank you, Tola.
Thanks, Mike.
Snatches you out of space, shifts you, drifts you, drops you. When you get back home, you realize you haven't left yet. Yet you were gone for 3,000 years.
jealous, waiting for you to stop for a moment. When you do, it snatches you out of space, shifts you, drifts you, drops you. When you get back home,